From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler.
I am here today with the author of Arts and Numbers, Elaine Grogan Luttrell, and this is a financial guide for artists, writers, performers, and other members of the creative class. Welcome, Elaine, to Craft.
Thank you, Doug. It's so nice to be here.
We had talked on the Craft website, craftheshow.com, and right after I had done an interview, and you suggested that an author who is also a writer who teaches writing and didn't necessarily talk to his students about the economics of being an author, other than I think he said, don't do it. Don't do it for money, which is constantly something I've heard. But he, you had taken issue with that and said that people should be talking about the money, should be talking about the economics of writing. And so I was happy to have you come on and talk about your book and about the ways that the creative class can make untold amounts of cash so that we can all be Katy Perry. We can all be. I was trying to come up with the one with the sledge, the wrecking ball.
Miley Cyrus, yes,
which is now the top end of professional and artistic.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I do think that incorporating some level of financial literacy into our creative curriculum, either at the educational level, sort of in college, at the undergrad or graduate level, and then also incorporating workshops for working creative professionals can help create a more sustainable career. I am not suggesting ever that, you know, people become accounting majors and pursue something creative on the side. That's the opposite of what I would like everyone to do. Okay. But I do love the idea that we can creatively incorporate some of these tangible business, financial, entrepreneurial, marketing skills into what our creative minds are already learning and thus build more sustainable careers. I won't guarantee that anyone will become the next Miley Cyrus, but perhaps that's not the end result that most of us want. Ideally, we all just need sort of a sustainable life.
This is an area that I think maybe is being talked about more now in colleges and places where people go to learn more about creativity and craft. So tell me a little bit about that. I mean, you got into this and maybe because you saw that that was a growth industry, maybe because you saw that there wasn't enough being talked about.
That's exactly right. I started my career as a young accountant with Ernst & Young, like many other young accountants, and I loved it, but I was looking for a little bit more fulfillment. So I volunteered for some arts organizations and then took a job with the Juilliard School. I was the director of financial analysis there. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, the students were asking for this information. They were weighing pros and cons of different career decisions and deciding whether or not an MFA would make sense for them creatively and professionally. And they were asking questions about how do I build a budget? You know, how do I sort of cobble together this freelance creative existence and still pay my rent and still maybe have a family one day and still retire and all of these things that, you know, professionals plan for on a regular basis. So at that point, I started sharing some of what I had learned as an accountant with the group, and then the business just kind of grew from there. It turns out there are a lot of people asking for this information. There was a SNAP secondary analysis that came out a couple years ago that found that many graduates of fine arts programs, and this was mostly visual arts, but I think it's true of many creative programs, they were saying that the level of exposure they had in school to tangible, practical financial skills that they needed in life was just simply lacking. So the students that are in schools now and recent grads are talking to their friends and realizing how important this is. So I expected to find a lot more resistance in presenting some of the material than I really have found.
Okay. Well, tell me about that. When you go in to talk to a group, what is the reaction like? You're saying you're not getting a lot of resistance. They're really into it. But is that something that you find with some of the people who are just ready to leave school or people that are coming in? Are they coming in with the idea that, hey, I really need to be paying attention to this all my way through school and really nailing it down?
I think they're realizing earlier in their careers and in their education that this is important. And remember, we're talking about young people who may have had itsy businesses since they were 9 or 10 years old. You know, there's a very entrepreneurial spirit running through a lot of our young people and the next generation of creative minds. So I think they're open to receiving the information. And I also think that I have an ability to present the information in a very relevant way. I'm not suggesting that I take an accounting 101 class and plop it into an arts program and just, you know, call it a day. Instead, we're taking very relevant accounting and financial information that's practical to someone who might pursue a creative career and presenting it in a very accessible way that, again, is relevant for the people digesting it.
Okay. So tell me about some of the most common things that you say. You've talked about it being relevant and accessible. What are some of the big tips that you, or not tips, some of the big areas that you cover and most frequently with folks in the arts and creative roles?
Well, for me, it always starts with goal setting. And sometimes that surprises people, but the only reason we do any of this financial planning, entrepreneurial stuff is to achieve our creative goals. So for me, we always start with goal setting and sort of envisioning how you would like your career to unfold, your professional life to unfold, your life more generally to unfold. And then how do we quantify those things and then develop some sort of path to get there? And sure enough, the quantification evolves into a budget. And then budgeting is a very natural next step. And we talk a lot about budgeting, both in the classes I teach and in the workshops I lead. And a lot of people are very intimidated by the idea of a budget, but it's imperfect. It's an iterative process. And to the extent that you can bring a lot of creativity to the process, I think it can be a very useful planning tool.
But is that something that people have a difficult time making? I mean, they may look at it and say, okay, on my budget, I'm going to have 3 art sales or 4 art sales, and yet that doesn't always come through for them, and then their budgets just don't work. Is that part of your job to say, look, you're expecting too much with 3 art sales. You're going to have 2 a year, and that's going to be your budget. Is that? I mean, that's the thing I've always thought, is that it's not necessarily that they're bad at the business side so much as they may be unrealistic about the kinds of return that they're going to get.
I think that's a very valid concern. And I have a 5-step budgeting process. And step 5 is always make it work. So if you're planning to have 2 or 3 art sales for a couple of $100 each, and yet you're looking at, you know, $20,000 of living expenses for a year, that clearly doesn't work. And that's where a lot of the creativity can come in. I describe this idea of having a career that's made up of a lot of different roles. There's a starring role, something that is very close to your heart, what you do, how you define yourself. And then you may have supporting cast roles that are related by industry or task to your starring role. And then you may have a lot of production assistance work, which is the unglamorous stuff that pays the bills sometimes. It's the temporary, repeatable work that you can always go back to. So by having the ability to juggle these different roles within a professional portfolio career, there's an ability to protect the starring role and also to play what if, those what if games you were mentioning. What if I don't sell 2 art pieces and I was hoping to, you know, could I then take up an extra teaching job or maybe write a couple guest blog posts or do some ghostwriting somewhere to complement my starring role? Or the converse is true too. What if I sell 15 works instead of just 2? What do I do then? Do I celebrate? Do I, you know, indulge and, you know, let my expense budget sort of blow up because I've been, you know, living on a shoestring for so long? Or do I plan a little bit more strategically?
I'm curious what your take is on working with creative folk versus working with more like business folk. Is that something that you notice trends where you say, I sometimes do this with some of our more artistic friends. Oh, right. She's a painter. You know, like it doesn't surprise me when budgets aren't met. And I don't necessarily mean that in the way that it comes out. It just, it's one of those things where you say somebody's in business probably because they're more interested in finance and they're more interested in the ways that money is made and exchanged versus somebody who's much more interested in, I just want to produce things because I enjoy producing them.
Yes, although I tend to say, wow, she's a painter, instead of, oh, right, she's a painter, because I really enjoy working with the creative minds because they are so much more comfortable with unpredictability. A lot of times when working with people who are naturally drawn to finance, budgeting, analytical type careers like that, oftentimes if something is imperfect, we're very uncomfortable with that. When I work with my creative clients, they are very uncomfortable or very comfortable in an unpredictable space, in an imperfect space where budgets can be wrong. And whether or not we're drawn to financial tasks or creative tasks or, you know, both equally, I think we all want sustainable existences, you know, and we define those in various different ways. But we all enjoy some level of predictability and we all hope for some level of fulfillment creatively. So what I hope to do is take some of these tools that maybe some people are more comfortable with and make them accessible so that they can be wrong, they can be imperfect, and they will be, and then we can use them to help get us to a better place, get us to those goals that we were hoping to accomplish.
Okay. Well, let's start with maybe some of your goals. How did you start with writing arts and numbers? What was your process for it? I mean, as an accountant, it's maybe writing a book may not be the first thing that comes to every accountant's mind, right?
Perhaps not.
So what you came up with this idea and said a book would be just a thing. Here's how I'm going to approach it. So walk me through that process for you.
Sure. Well, for me, it was sort of a very logical next step. I had done a number of presentations, a number of workshops. I had started to develop curriculum for some of the college level courses I teach at the Columbus College of Art and Design and also the Ohio State University. And I was finding many people who I was encountering were asking the same questions over and over again. And they were a little different, but they were mostly the same questions over and over again. And I said, I'm one person. I can answer them one-on-one, you know, until I'm blue in the face. And I can also gather together the answers in one place. So that's kind of how the idea for the book started. And then I started sorting the different topics into some kind of logical order. And it just kind of grew from there.
Okay. How long did that take you, that whole process? From the beginning until you turned in your draft, what was that time frame for you?
It was at least about 18 months. Okay. And it went through a lot of changes during that 18-month period. And we had actually two pretty solid drafts. The first one I turned in after about 18 months, and then about 3 months later, we had scrapped 20,000 words and put a new 20,000 words in. I mean, it was a very sort of iterative process. And I think the book is better for it.
Okay. That's a really, I guess in some ways surprising, given that there's a lot of movement towards, you know, you do the book and it gets published, and that kind of editorial feedback, which is, I'm assuming, what led you to scrap 20,000 words. What a most cruel editor. That's not the kind of editorial feedback I might have expected. With a first book.
She wasn't cruel. She was absolutely right. She really was. And the wonderful thing about the process is how the material evolved. And remember, the editor and many of the people I was working with did come from more creative fields. So they were reading this in a very kind of reflective way and providing immediate feedback about things that translated well, things that made sense, and things that were just too far off topic to be useful for a creative audience.
Okay. Now, is this something that you're going to repeat? Now that you've got one book, do you think, hey, that wasn't so bad? It only took 21 months, right? Why not? You're looking at me with a, it's a difficult expression to figure out. But is that something you think in your future, there's Arts and Numbers 2, the sequel. This time it's even more personal.
Absolutely. I loved the process. And for me, I am an example of someone who has a portfolio career. I work with clients and I teach and I write and I do a lot of things related to building financial literacy among artists and arts organizations. So for me, having another book, Arts and Numbers 2, for a nonprofit group, or having another work that focuses more on pricing your work. How do you develop a pricing strategy? What informs your pricing strategy? These are all ideas that we continue to kick around, and I think there's a lot of room for them there.
It also seems to me like another version of this is going to be how to watch out getting into contracts, right? I mean, because you hear so many things about creative people. I mean, I think Bruce Springsteen, maybe this is apocryphal or whatever, but signed his first contract on the foot of a Ford or something like this, you know, after a gig. Sure, here's the rest of my life. Or Billy Joel,
right,
or somebody like that. Is that also something that is a big hole that isn't being fulfilled right now that you're thinking?
I think there are some works attempting to fulfill the hole. It might be, you know, arts and legalities or something like that. And I am not an attorney. I'm just an accountant. But a lot of these issues cross over into legal space and tax space and accounting space. And at CCAD, for example, there is a class on sort of law for artists, if you will. And what's wonderful about that is that the students are there and they're learning about copyrights and they're learning about, you know, interesting legal things that they need to juggle and contracts, like you mentioned.
Now, before we end, I want to point out that in 2007, you won a 6-word poetry contest.
I did.
And I was wondering if you remember that poem well enough.
I certainly do.
I don't want to stress the old memory, but if you would, that would be an interesting poem to hear.
Yes. Well, this poem, all 6 words of it were written over lunch the day I learned about this poetry contest. And it was sponsored by Smith Magazine, authors of the 6-word memoirs. And it's just a wonderful outlet and a reawakened my creativity, if you will. It is confidence feigned, successes gained, enthusiasm waned.
Okay. And is that a chronological view of your career then, that you started off with feigning confidence, then you moved to success, but then you grew tired of it? Was this the way that you quit your job that you were writing that day?
It was. I had already quit. I had already moved on. But yes, that's absolutely true. And I think it happens to many of us. We make decisions at 18, 19, 20, 22 years old. And, you know, all of a sudden, sometimes we get everything we think we always wanted. And then we realize that maybe we didn't want it all after all. Mm. And for me, that was a very awakening moment. And that is almost the exact time that I left Ernst & Young and took the job at Juilliard, because I was searching for that lost enthusiasm.
Okay. You mentioned Juilliard earlier, and one of the things that I always think of is the people that go through Juilliard, like Robin Williams. Is there somebody that stood out to you that you thought this person was really going to have an impact, and not necessarily like acting, but there's a whole range of arts that are performed at Juilliard, right?
That's right. Music, dance, and drama. For me, the most impactful people were the people on the staff. Almost everyone had creative pursuits in addition to the work they were already doing. And the passion that everyone there felt for supporting and educating students, I think, was monumental. Joseph Polisi is the president, and he had an incredible impact on me just in his kindness and his compassion and his support for young artists and the next generation of artists. And I think Denny Griffith at CCAD falls into that same category. I remember being in a meeting once with Denny, and he mentioned that as educators, our role is to help students become more fully themselves. And I loved that take on education, because whether we're teaching them about finance or, you know, techniques for acrylics or how to structure a proper sentence, you know, our ability and our sort of passion for helping the students become the fullest version of themselves, I think, is a really powerful way to think about what we're doing.
Okay. Elaine Grogan-Littrell, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Here today with me on Craft. The book, again, is called Arts and Numbers, and we'll have it on the website, and people can buy multiple copies of it there and help your budget as you look to the future.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.